I'm Will Griffin, and this is Live in Studio C at Classical 91.1. We have something a little out of the ordinary today. The Nashville Symphony Chamber Chorus is here with our director, Tucker Biddlecombe, and they'll be performing music of Mozart and American composer John Harbison, and that will be the unusual part in that we'll be hearing selections of the Harbison American and American Requiem, and Tucker Biddlecombe will be speaking about the sections and giving a little more background and context for the piece as we go along today. Welcome, everyone. Good to see you. Thanks for being here on this this day.
Thanks, Will. We're thrilled to be here and share a little bit of what we've been doing this season.
And that's a lot, apparently. So I'm just going to hand it over to you, Tucker, and do what you will with the time.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you. We will start our program today with a piece that Mozart wrote when he was 14 years old. I don't know what you were doing when you were 14, but I wasn't writing great sacred music like this. This is called the Veni Sancte Spiritus, and it's just an energetic, lively piece that you would expect of a very, very young Mozart.
Oh, okay.
piece by Mozart written when Mozart was little at age 14. Well, he might not have been so little, I'm not sure. Anyway, that was National Symphony Chamber Chorus live in Studio C, directed by Tucker Biddlecombe, and the pianist was Jeff Burnham. A lovely little piece. Any more? Do we know anything more about how that piece came about?
You know,
I'm sort of throwing you a curveball here, but
it's really... Really, we know so little about Mozart's young life aside from the fact that, of course, he was a student of his father, and he was writing things all the time. The one thing, so everybody's seen Amadeus,
right?
And of course, everyone knows that particular, you know, the sort of trope about, you know, he was writing music and he was just this ridiculously talented young person who was able to do so many things that other people couldn't do, and people were jealous, and he was a little vulgar. And of course, it's highly dramatized, but there's one particular thing that is actually true. There's a moment in that movie where Salieri is going through Mozart's copies, things of, you know, copies of music that he's never published or has never sent out. And Salieri marvels at the fact that Mozart's copies have no corrections, that the very music that he's doing is always flawless from the moment that it goes from his pencil to the paper.
All there.
It's all there, and just no corrections, no copies. And I've seen some of those facsimiles, and there are no corrections. It came from Mozart's brain, went right onto the page from a very, very young age,
which
is, of course, very exciting.
Well, thank you for singing Veni Sancte Spiritus, that's Kurzweil number 47 by Mozart, the National Symphony Chamber Chorus, live in Studio C with their director, Tucker Biddlecombe. I'm going to ask you to say a little bit about yourself at this point. I know you've been in Nashville about 5 years. Give us some context. You do more than a little bit around here.
So. Of course. I was thrilled to come to Nashville 5 years ago as the director of choral activities at Vanderbilt University's Blair School of Music. I was a high school teacher before I ever came into the collegiate teaching ranks. I taught in New York and Florida for about 10 years. I loved teaching high school. It was a wonderful, wonderful vocation for me. I did decide to enter doctoral study, and you know, when you look around for collegiate positions, you never know what you're going to get. You could wind up halfway around the country. My wife is also a fine choral director. She directs the Blair Children's Chorus, which also collaborates often with us in the National Symphony. And we were thrilled to have the opportunity to come to Nashville and discover the wonderful artistic community that was already here. What I've been most pleased about in my time as the interim director of the Nashville Symphony Chorus, and I'll assume the full-time chorus directorship next season, has just been the chorus's willingness to try new things and Nashville's willingness to try new things. The city is just experiencing a boom like it's never experienced before. And I, you know, every day I read the paper and I read another article about, well, we're expanding here and we're creating this new business and this new territory. And while I know for some it's a little off-putting, especially people who've lived here their whole lives, for people who have just moved here, it's just such an exciting time.
It's really a frothy time, isn't it?
Yeah, it really, really is. And the artistic community is also extremely open and extremely just absolutely ready to experience new things. And one of the things that I'm most excited about with our mission in the Nashville Symphony is to do new music and to do music of living American composers. So I feel like our community is ready for these new experiences and these new pieces.
Well, tell us about the piece by John Harbison called An American Requiem, which we're going to hear parts of today.
Well, John Harbison is a living American composer. He writes a great deal for orchestra, writes a great deal for the voice. As a matter of fact, he is also quite a fine singer. He's the only person to ever been accepted at Tanglewood Music Center for voice and composition, which is quite an impressive distinction if you know anything about that summer music home of the Boston Symphony. And this piece was written in response to 9/11, but it's not a programmatic work. You're not going to hear big percussive blasts or, you know, weeping motives like you would in Bach. This is a closer representation in music to an emotional context. Think of the Brahms Requiem, where although it's not programmatically related to something necessarily, you can hear that anguish and you can hear that pain and you can hear how the composer tailors the text and the music to fit his own proclivities, either religious or spiritual proclivities, in order to make a really emotional projection of what they're feeling. And this piece was written in response to the attacks in 9/11. It was commissioned by the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and it's only received one performance in its history. We will be the second performance, and we will also be recording this work over the course of our performances to be the premiere recording of this work. So we will be wonderful. The reference. We'll be in every we'll be in every music library in the country to sort of lay down the default performance of what this piece should be, which we're very excited about.
We should say the concerts for that recording will be Friday, May 12th and Saturday, May 13th at 8 p.m.
That's right. And tickets are available on the Nashville Symphony website. So we would love our wonderful burgeoning artistic community to come out and experience something new.
Well, let's hear this music of John Harbison.
Well, here's what I think would be the best way to do this is that we won't sing any complete movements. Instead, one of the things that I find about attending symphony concerts is that if you have a context or a knowledge of what that piece is going to be, you feel much more comfortable attending and you know what to expect. For example, if you go to see a concert of Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique and you know that it's essentially there are portions about the French Revolution, that it eventually somebody's going to get their head cut off and it is programmatically represented in the music, you feel a lot cooler coming to the symphony and knowing that that's going to happen. So what we'll do is we'll take you through excerpts of this particular piece of music. Now, the Mozart Requiem starts in D minor. And here's a D minor tonality from Jeff. Now, our sopranos and our altos and tenors cover those notes in D minor. So, and of course, a requiem is a sad occasion, so a minor chord is appropriate. So our tenors and altos and sopranos will sing the first phrase. Ready? Very good. Now, of course, because this is John Harbison and because this is modern American music, dissonance is a tool that European composers in the 19th century not only didn't use, but really weren't allowed to use. Often the church frowned on discipline. As a matter of fact, going all the way back to the Renaissance, there were certain intervals that composers were not allowed to use because they were considered the devil's interval. For example, the tritone or the diminished fifth. They would always avoid that in two-point counterpoint because in order to maintain the wishes that all of the church's music be consonant and that the text always be in the forefront. Well, now we add the bass notes. So here's the soprano, alto, and tenor notes. And then we add a bass D flat. So all of a sudden we have that D minor chord colored with a D flat in the bass, which creates enough dissonance to create an ominous effect. Now here are all the voices singing. You could hear the et lux perpetua luceat eis, light eternal, and you hear the same particular chord formation. On the et lux, you hear the soprano and the alto in the tenor in a normal first inversion A minor triad. And then you hear the basses messing up the party again with an A flat. And all together, the same dissonant intervals are created, which creates a unique color and a unique idea that Harbison will once again always go back to the well. He's always going back to these consonant chords colored by one dissonant interval. And a fun game to play when you're at the concert is trying to find where the dissonance is. It's almost like Where's Waldo? Now, the next section that we'll take a look at is another example of a musical device that Harbison uses, just like Bach did, just like Beethoven did. It's called fugue, where you have one particular entrance that one voice part does, and then another voice part takes that same thing and repeats it, maybe in a different key or in a different interval. So what we'll do is the whole choir will sing the opening Christe Eleison fugue, and we'll do both parts. We'll do the first part, which is very long and legato, and the next part, which is short and choppy. All right? So here is our C sharp at measure 94. Fugue has two parts to it. There's the main statement and the counter subject. And what you heard was the subject, and that is the Christe Eleison. And the counter subject is Christe. And it'll be really easy to pick out all of those different subjects and counter subjects when you hear the overlapping voices. So now we'll do the same thing, but this time the altos start the fugue, and then you'll hear the sopranos come in, and then you'll hear the basses come in, and you'll hear the tenors come in, and see if you can follow the fugue line from the very beginning all the way to the end of this excerpt. The different parts, it's just like a fugue that Beethoven would write, or it's just like a fugue that Mendelssohn would write, except of course with the added dissonant figures, you hear the structure, but you don't necessarily maybe hear the tune. I don't know that you'll walk out of the Harbison humming that tune, but it will make sense to you throughout later in the work because those same intervallic relationships are used very often. Now, another musical device or a movement from a requiem that people always really love is the dies irae. Mm-hmm. I can think of the Verdi requiem's dies irae, you know, with the big bass drums and the boom, boom, and the Mozart dies irae, where, there's just this driving rhythm and sort of an angry tenor to everything. And of course, no, I said angry tenor. I don't mean my angry tenors. I mean tenor in the other sort of word. But the dies irae is a favorite part of every requiem, I think. And this piece is no exception. It's the same sort of driving rhythm and energy. And we'll perform a little longer excerpt of that. This is the Day of Wrath, or dies irae, from John Harbison's American Requiem.
Thank you.
Very exciting, very angular, very rhythmic, lots of text, lots of syncopation. You'll hear tons of percussion in the orchestra, lots of brass, lots of powerful string writing. It holds its own with the great Dies Irae of all the requiems that I've ever heard. Now, when we're talking about references to European composers, it's important to first note what the differences are. I talked about dissonance and the difference between what a 19th century composer would do as opposed to a 21st century composer. 21st century composers are not hindered by using certain kinds of harmony. I mean, Gyorgy Ligeti would write in quarter tones, and he felt comfortable doing that. Of course, as a singer, you never entirely feel comfortable singing quarter tones. You really, really take a lot
trained.
Of, yeah, certainly. It takes a lot of training, and some of us sing in accidental quarter tones, which of course is not what we want. But at the beginning of the Tuba Mirum, I'm sure you heard a lot of piling dissonance, and I want you to know that it's not just random, is that all of the dissonance is very mathematically perceived. So at the beginning of the Tuba Mirum, you hear an open fifth in the voice parts. So you'll hear an open perfect fifth, and then the next note is dissonant, and then the next note is dissonant, and then back to perfect fifth. Now, sopranos are going to sing their first line at the Tuba Mirum, and here's what it sounds like. Ready? Excellent. Now, the tenors have a similar line, except it's a palindrome, which means that there is a middle line. Think of a painting or a picture where the mountains are on the top and they're also on the bottom, divided by the water. The tenors have their line. Ready? And... So they go down when the sopranos go up. The sopranos go up when they go down. And together, it sounds like this. Now, the altos and the basses have a similar pattern, except their interval is two half steps or a whole step. The altos sound like this. And the basses sound like this. And together, when you put those together, you'd be surprised. It doesn't sound very dissonant at all. Ready?
Tuba mirum.
But then you add the sopranos and the tenors, and all of a sudden the dissonance party begins. And...
Tuba mirum.
Now, the idea about that, of course, it creates tension, and all dissonance creates tension, but it also creates release. Because each time that fifth comes back, it releases whatever tension was done. I got a massage for the first time in a few years, a couple weeks ago. And boy, if I could go back to what I felt like when I walked out of that massage parlor, I wish I could be there right now. But essentially, it's the same thing, is that we sort of contort ourselves, and then we find relaxation, contortion and relaxation. And I think the most exciting thing about new music is it's easy to do that. It's easy to create that with intervals. So intervals are the space between two notes. We start with a half step, then a whole step, a minor third, major third, perfect fourth. And if you went to music school, you're probably starting to twitch because you'll think this is a theory exam. It's not. But I do want to point out that lovers of music theory, or people who love the inner workings of music, say, one of the reasons I love Bach is because I can hear all of the inner workings within the music. Well, people will love this piece too. Now, at the beginning of the Liber Scriptus, you will hear another palindrome, but it's a longer palindrome. And it's in what I call, and I've coined this phrase, an intervallic palindrome, which means this. The first interval that you hear in the voices is a perfect fifth between the soprano, alto, tenor, and bass. It sounds like this. And then the next interval you'll hear is this, which is a diminished fifth. It's one half step difference. And then the next interval is a perfect fourth. Here comes the bride. And then the next interval, a major third. The next interval, a minor third. Next interval, major second. And then the next interval, oh, it's another major second. So now we've started to move back up the other side. Thank you. So we've gone from perfect fifth to major second, and then all the way back up again. It's like he drew a big line in the middle of those two passages and put a mirror there. So if you hear the voice parts sing that, this is what it sounds like. If you noticed, the perfect fifth is in a different key at the end of that line than it is at the beginning. So here's where we started in D flat, open fifth, and here's where we ended. And somewhere along the way, we modulate by a half step, and it's easy to miss that particular little thing. Sometimes in a piece like this, I wish the composer would get up and say, hey, I did this really cool thing here, and I want you to notice it. You're not going to notice it unless I tell you about it. And the score study that I get to do as part of being the director of this group really opens up my eyes to all of the things that the composers were trying to put into the piece that perhaps the even an avid listener wouldn't necessarily connect to, which is a really, really fun part of my job. Now, going to the back to European Requiems, famous Verdi and Mozart, the Confutatis is another exciting Mozartian part of the Mozart Requiem. And of course, I think we know that Mozart only wrote parts of the Requiem. He was near death when he wrote it. But this is one of the things that we are pretty certain that he wrote, this Confutatis section. So Jeff will play a little bit of this beginning.
Confutatis, maledictis, flammis ac.
And if you've seen Amadeus, that's a very famous part of that, where Mozart is dictating to Salieri on his deathbed, and it's this beautiful sort of, how he would have described the music. It's one of my favorite scenes in that film. This Requiem also has a Confutatis, and it's very, very similar vein. Now here you heard the Mozart Confutatis. This is the Harbison Confutatis. Very different, still very driving rhythm. It's got the same text, exactly the same text, just set in a dramatically different way. And if you love this text, if you love these Requiem texts, if you love this again, you're going to hear very, very similar themes and very, very similar ideas as you would in Mendelssohn or Mozart or Bach or Brahms. Now, everybody talks about the rhythmic aspects of modern music as a challenging thing. We would call it, as musicians, we call it mixed meter. A very, very famous mixed meter that you might be pretty familiar with, or your listeners might be pretty familiar with, is 7/8, where we feel 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There's that old adage of, does it have a good beat and can I dance to it? The answer is yes, you can dance to 7/8, but you end up looking like Elaine in that Seinfeld episode. Very strange. 7/8 could have a variety of different divisions. You have to divide 7 beats in a non-equal way. So we could have 2 plus 2 plus 3 equals 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Or you could have 3 plus 2 plus 2. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You could have even 2 plus 3 plus 2, which actually is a symmetrical meter within 7/8. So it does feel symmetrical, but only in three parts. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Or actually, the beat 4 becomes the middle of the bar because of the way that it's divided. Now, the Sanctus in the John Harbison Requiem goes through all of the iterations of 7/8. It's a big 7/8 party, and it takes you through all the different doors and all the windows of what that meter has to offer. So here's the beginning in each part of the Sanctus of the Harbison, and let's see if we can figure out what it is. 2 plus 3 plus 2 or 3 plus 2 plus 2. This is a fun game for you while you're driving. So that was 2 + 2 + 3. Now let's go to the next one.
Sanctus, Dominus, Dominus, Deus Sabaoth.
That was 2 + 3 + 2. Sanctus, Sanctus, Dum Dida Dumba, which feels a little bit different. And now the next one. That one was 3 + 2 + 2. Creates a much different feeling, and then this one is also 3 + 2 + 2, but you'll hear a much different rhythmic context. So each of those iterations create a different character, but it still has the same sort of driving and electronic rhythm, which is very exciting. Of course, you'll hear drums, you'll hear a variety of percussion instruments. And when I say that this is not a programmatic work for 9/11, meaning that it doesn't have the sounds of a cityscape like the John Adams piece would. It doesn't have the kind of, it doesn't have voices or names being recited. Instead, it's just an emotional reaction to that particular piece, which I think gives it a wonderful, unique context. Now, that musical device gives way to something that's even a little bit more reminiscent of Renaissance music. Open fifths. You'll hear this next section, the Cum Sanctis Tuis, as part of the Lux Aeterna in the Harbison, and it's going to sound maybe a little bit like a Palestrina motet or something that Thomas Tallis would have written. There's that open fifth coming back one more time, which I think is where Mr. Harbison loves to rest. A lot of the ending phrases end up being those open fifths, which of course in music, it kind of gives a sort of an open-ended quality. The open fifth without the third, it doesn't tell us how to feel about anything, which is one of my favorite things in music, when composers are astute enough not to tell us how we're supposed to feel. And I think Mr. Harbison is particularly astute at that. The last connection that I'd like to make, and the last excerpt that I'd like to perform, is the In Paradisum, which is the last movement of this particular Requiem. Now, if you know the Fauré Requiem, it's generally recognized as the most beautiful piece of music for chorus and orchestra that's ever been written. And the In Paradisum is particularly angelic and beautiful. And this In Paradisum, while it is lovely and lyric to sing, does not have the same sort of beauty standard or beauty bias that perhaps Fauré might have had. I love contemporary music. I love the music of living composers. And I realize that many of our listeners or our friends do not, especially even lovers of classical music, do not love music that's coming out. There are two analogies I'd like to make. The first one is an article by David Lang, the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer who wrote The Little Match Girl Passion. Now, I've heard performances of The Little Match Girl Passion, and it is a disturbing piece of music. You sit and you feel cold and alone, and that's actually quite the purpose of that piece. Not every piece is meant to aesthetically please. And he wrote a wonderful article in the New York Times some years ago where he likened to a sporting event. is that we don't go to sporting events, we don't go to a baseball game and expect to see Game 5 of the 1964 World Series replayed for us. We would think that's very strange, and we wouldn't want to see play for play that same thing. We want to see a new game. And I think that's a wonderful analogy to make for new music, is sometimes people want to come back and hear the same things. And don't worry, at the Nashville Symphony, we'll keep playing those things. But we also want you to experience some new things as well, which is why on this concert, Schumann's first symphony is also being played, which I think will be a really wonderful sort of palate inducer for this piece. The second inference I'd like to make is the Voyager spacecraft. Now, the Voyager spacecraft was sent out with a rudimentary record player. Let's say another civilization might find this, you know, and figure out how to play these sounds. And there were sounds of nature, and there were sounds of rain falling, and there were sounds of music. I think Hank Williams was on there, and I think Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, generally recognized as probably the greatest piece of Western music. Now, let's say another civilization finds Voyager and they listen to Beethoven 9. I don't think they'll think it's beautiful. As a matter of fact, I think they'll think it sounds very strange, because we have invented our own diatonic languages in our species. And what if we found their Voyager spacecraft with their most beautiful music? I don't know that we would find it very beautiful. We'd find it fascinating, but we would not find it necessarily aesthetically pleasing to us, because it doesn't fit the biases that we have about our own music. So this In Paradisum, I liken it to the end of the Fourier Requiem. You just have to think of it in such a way as to expand your idea of what beautiful music is, expand that aesthetic bias that we all inherently have about music. So here's the In Paradisum, and one of the things that I'm most excited about being a part of the Nashville Symphony is how we champion living composers and 20th century music, 21st century music. Is in the eye of the beholder. When you're listening to music like this, an expanded idea of what art is, you know, it's like looking at a painting by Jackson Pollock, or it's trying to maybe understand something that, while we don't have the immediate knowledge to really understand it, it takes us in a whole different direction than what we think music is going to take us in. And for us as a chorus, it has been a real honor to have the chance to bring this piece of music to life for only its second performance. So we were thrilled to share the Harbison Requiem with you on your show today, Will. Thank you.
Wow, thank you, Tucker Biddlecombe, and the Nashville Symphony Chamber Chorus for a wonderful introduction to the music by John Harbison that will be performed with the Nashville Symphony Orchestra on Friday, May 12th at 8 p.m. and Saturday, May 13th at 8 p.m. at the Skirmore and Symphony Center. That was some great context giving, I have to tell you.
Thank you.
Tucker Biddlecombe, thank you very much. And pianist Jeff Burnham, thank you for your part today as well. And you talked about maybe having some of the singers come up and
say
this.
Well, this has been a really unique learning process. And, you know, we've all gotten something a little bit different from it, I think. And, you know, I've been living with this piece for a little over a year now. When we first got it, it was a handwritten piano score, and it was a little hard to read. So one of the first things I did was sat down and I engraved it in a music notation program. So I've been living with this score for a long time. So, of course, my biases are to really love it because I've been having the chance to study it. Although for a lot of our singers, this is really one of the first times that you know, that they've studied music like this or worked on something like this. And I would just love to hear some of their perspectives, you know, perhaps just about what it was, because they're sick of hearing me talk.
Introduce yourself.
My name is Sarah Curtis. I've been singing with the Nashville Symphony Chorus for 2 years. And for myself, one of the best parts about learning this music is how much it brought us together as a chorus. We rehearse Monday nights, we're a volunteer chorus, and we're rushing in busy from our days, and we sit down and we get this time to work together, and pushing ourselves beyond our comfort zone of music has really allowed us to learn and explore and grow as a group.
It's a very deep and rich, almost tactile experience that you're having with this music, isn't it?
Indeed it is, Will. My name is Brian Warford, and I've been so privileged to be a part of this group for over 20 years. And as Dr. Biddlecombe was saying earlier, we are used to singing music like Verdi Requiem, Mozart Requiem, Beethoven 9, Handel Messiah every year. While those are always a thrill, can become somewhat routine. And so what I have really enjoyed about the Harbison is that it has caused me to wake up a little bit and sort of kick in my need to study again, because a lot of those other pieces, I know them almost by heart. But this would be quite a stunt if somebody could memorize, and because just learning the notes and the rhythms and the intervals on an individual basis has been extremely challenging, and then putting that together with the rest of the group so that we can tune all of these intervals, some of which you've heard today, is a whole nother level of challenge. And so I've just been very grateful that our conductor, Maestro Guerrero, and Dr. Biddlecombe and the Nashville Symphony have been willing to program this piece and give me that chance to really expand my musical horizons as an individual and as part of our group.
Well, I think you guys, as members of the Nashville Symphony Chorus, should give yourselves a hand for the hard work you've done. And we'll remind, well, go ahead and give yourselves a hand. We've had members of the Nashville Symphony Chamber Chorus today live in Studio C with Dr. Tucker Biddlecombe, their director, and pianist Jeff Burnham. Give yourselves an opportunity as listeners to come out and experience a wonderful new composition, recent composition anyway, by a fine American composer, a rich experience at the Skirmore Symphony Center Friday, May 12th and Saturday, May 13th. And thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you, Will. We're thrilled to have the opportunity. And you'll also hear a live recording, which is very exciting. And also, you might even get to meet the composer, which is very exciting.
That doesn't happen every day.
No, certainly not.
I'm Will Griffin. This is Live in Studio C. Our thanks to our engineer, Carl Peterson. And thanks to the Tennessee Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Middle Tennessee, and First Tennessee Foundation for their kind and generous support of these efforts here at Nashville Public Radio. We're sort of in an unexpected spring choral fest here at Live in Studio C. We had the Nashville Symphony Chamber Chorus today. Coming up next week, Vox Grata Women's Choir is here. And on May 16th, Portara Ensemble. So choral music is happening live in Studio C. Thanks for listening.